MacCast, Friday, October 21st, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, quite a week in Apple news this week. We have a number of stories to cover for you. Lots of stuff going on. One of the first things that we need to talk about is some good news. If you're looking for a new Mac, there may be some new Mac models coming. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Things are happening with different keyboard designs. Apple's been kind of thinking out of the box there a little bit, maybe. We're going to get into that. Big changes for Apple's car project. Talk a little bit more about AR, VR, and sort of Apple and Tim Cook's thoughts on that. Apple trying to push HomeKit a little bit more, something that I've been wanting to see them do. And it's you'll be interested to hear what they're up to in that arena. We're going to talk a little bit about Apple Store redesigns. We've got the fourth quarter numbers for Apple, or fourth fiscal quarter numbers for Apple coming up. That always get confused with how they run their quarters. That's going to be coming up in a little bit. So we're going to talk about some of the predictions that Wall Street and analysts are looking at, especially for iPhone 7 and how sales might be going on there. And some concerns if you bought an Apple Genuine Charger recently from a certain big online retailer. Apple discovered some issues there. We're going to talk about that. So we have all of that. And then some feedback fixes for iPhone issues on LTE. We're going to talk about what happens if your iPhone 7 home button breaks. Get into Siri analysis a little bit. I want to talk about Siri and some of the comparisons to maybe some of the other digital assistants that are out there. There's been a lot of opinions flying around, so I want to dig into that with you. And then some hints and tips, an iOS 10 tip. We're going to talk about encryption and Time Machine. And then I have a great thing of the moment for you this week. Well, great or awful, really, but maybe a little bit of both. And you'll figure out what I mean by that when we get to the end of the show here. So stay tuned. Great show. Lots of good things to get into. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you again about Text Expander. I know I've told you about it before, but that's because I love it. It's something I've used for years. I can't live without it. I have it on every Mac, every iOS device I own. If you pick one up, you'll find Text Expander on there. And the reason is it allows me to communicate much more efficiently. I can get through many more texts, many more emails, all of those things with less typing. And I love saving time. I don't know about you, but it's a big thing for me. You know, anything you do throughout your day, whether it be in your job, your personal life, if you're finding yourself typing the same thing more than once, over and over, all that repetitive typing, you can take those things and turn them into Text Expander snippets. And that way you can just type a few characters. It will expand out that text automatically right there from anywhere on your Mac. You can use the Text Expander keyboard on iOS and use your snippets there. They all sync through iCloud or through Dropbox, however you want to sync them. And it's great. I use them for various email signatures that I have, different blocks of code because I'm a coder, even replies for emails on the MacCast. And when you're using them for something like email replies, they don't have to be just boring boilerplate replies, because there's actually advanced substitution stuff inside Text Expander. You can have optional elements. You can have images. You can have text substitution that happens automatically. So as you're expanding the snippet, it will ask you to have fill-in parts of your snippet, and then you can customize it. You can even go so far as to add scripting. So you can make these things super powerful. And if you create a really cool snippet, guess what? You can share it as well. You can share it with your friends, your coworkers, your office. It's great in office environments, especially if you have support teams, things like that, and you want consistent communication. And if you're wondering, you know, it seems a little bit overwhelming. How am I going to figure out how to use this thing? Check out the Text Expander Tips section of the Smile blog. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. I found a great tip over there on setting up snippets for presentations. I do presentations to user groups all the time, and they say, you know what, set up anything that you need to type out. If you're doing your demo and you need some text typed out, why not just put that into a snippet ahead of time? You can even organize them together, and that way you can avoid typing errors. You can avoid any kind of embarrassment as you're doing that. I thought that was a great tip, and I found it on the Smile blog. Best of all, you can try out Text Expander free for 30 days, and when you get a Text Expander subscription, you get the software for Mac, iPad, iPhone, and they even have a Windows beta out right now. So you can have that across all the platforms that you use. And a huge deal for MacCast listeners this month from Smile, you can get a 50% discount off your first year of a Text Expander Life Hacker subscription. Just visit smilesoftware.com/MacCast. It's going to give you the details and your discount. But hurry up, because this deal ends November 15th. That is a great price on Text Expander. So if you've been waiting to jump in, now is the time to do it. Check it out, smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the show. Okay, if you're a Mac fan like myself, if you aren't just living in the iOS world, if you also appreciate your iMac or your Mac Mini or your MacBook or whatever your Mac of choice is, then you've probably been feeling like I have, a little left out in terms of the updates. Apple has been letting their Macs get a little bit long in the tooth lately, and we haven't had many announcements related to Macs. Well, that is all about to change. Finally, as we expected, Apple sent out invites for a special event coming up here next week on the 27th. Invites went out to the media. They are going to have a media event at the Apple campus in Cupertino starting at 10 a.m. It is going to be live streamed, so we're going to be able to all follow along. And the invite has a very strong indication that this is an all Mac event. It simply says hello again. It kind of has an Apple logo with a, you know, painted, it's actually kind of just the top half of the logo with a painted sort of cloudscape kind of thing inside the Apple. Now, I don't get into the whole tea leaf thing of trying to read a lot into the invite. I know that occasionally Apple will put little hints in there. If you remember, they kind of had hints of the bokeh effect in the invite for the last iPhone special event. I'm not going to read too much into it, but the text, I think, is always very significant. And hello again, if you remember the original iMac launch when Steve Jobs came back to Apple, brought Apple back in, you know, back to life, really, back then. The original Bondi iMac that was released, that was, use the marketing term, hello again. So I think this is really an indication, and it's something significant that says this is going to be a significant Mac event. So not just a Mac-focused event, but something significant is going to be happening here. And what's expected is the new MacBook Pro models, both the 13 and the 15-inch sizes. They're going to be thinner, lighter, and have the MacBook style keyboard. It's expected that they will also include the latest generation Intel Skylake processors. Some people are hoping that we'll see Kaby Lake, but I don't think that is very likely just based on the timing. We've talked about that in a prior episode. So Skylake processors along with the latest integrated graphics that go with those, and on the higher-end models, new GPUs from AMD. It's also expected that Apple is going to standardize the ports on the USB-C connector. And beyond USB-C, the only other port that's expected is a headphone jack. So no HDMI, no SD card, no MagSafe. But that doesn't matter all that much, because all of those things are capable over the USB-C port. It is expected that Apple is going to add Thunderbolt 3 support. Again, another technology that can run over the USB-C connector. So just having that one universal connector, I think, really simplifies things and adds a lot of flexibility. The big question is going to be, how many USB-C ports are you going to get in there? It's pretty much believed that you're going to have more than the MacBook, so it's not just going to be one. That's going to have to carry your power, your Thunderbolt, any other kind of adapters for hardwired Ethernet. If you need HDMI, of course, it does DisplayPort. So I would hope that we would see, since existing MacBook Pros have two Thunderbolt ports and two USB ports, I would hope we would see four USB ports on the new MacBook Pros, although some of the rumors are indicating there might only be two. I think that's too few, especially for a Pro model. So we'll just have to see what Apple ends up announcing. The biggest change rumored to the MacBook Pro, though, is this new OLED touchscreen that is going to replace the area where the current function keys are. We now are hearing that this thing is being dubbed the Magic Toolbar, and the name comes from a trademark filing by Presto Apps America LLC. It was discovered by a guy named Brian Conroy over at the Trademark Ninja. And if you're going, well, Presto Apps America, that, how's that relate to Apple? Well, he made a case that the filing for that trademark cost about 16,000 euros. And the fact that Apple has the tendency towards the magic naming convention means that you'd have to be really, what's a delicate way to put this? You'd have to be really dumb to try and think that you could get anything branded as magic and not get sued by Apple, at least in the technology sphere. So he's going, you know, the cost plus that means that this is probably a pretty good sign that this is an Apple trademark. And Apple does set up kind of these dummy companies to file trademarks to kind of hide what they're up to. So they'll set up these little, I guess, shell companies, you might call them, and put forth the trademark under that. And a little bit of further evidence is that the trademark application for Magic Toolbar was filed by the same lawyers who applied for the AirPods trademark. And we all know what happened with AirPods because of the iPhone 7 event. There have been other rumored names: Control Strip, Touch Bar, Smart Button. I'm not sure how I feel about Magic Toolbar in general. But the idea here is that in software, you would be able to dynamically display different information, different keys, and because it's touch sensitive, you can have different kinds of areas that make sense for various applications. So I'm hoping it's not just that Apple introduces the touch bar, but they also introduce an API that's made available immediately to developers. And I would expect that we would see actually a developer partner come out on stage. My best guess is it would be somebody like Adobe that could really show off the technology and how the ability to kind of customize that function area via an app would add a lot of really cool power to what you could do with a keyboard like that. So that's pretty cool. It's also being rumored that the new MacBook Pros will be the first Macs to have Touch ID integration so that you can use Apple Pay. Apple announced Apple Pay on the web with Mac OS Sierra. And so that seems like a natural progression. I think we're going to see Touch ID across Apple's entire product line and making its way into Macs and maybe accessories in the future, like keyboards or trackpads or something like that, would make a lot of sense. So that's the MacBook Pro. Now, there have been some rumors claiming that there may be an update to the MacBook Air lineup, bringing out a USB-C-based MacBook Air. But personally, I think that line is done. I think Apple's not going to talk about the MacBook Air. The rumors are saying that it could just be the 13-inch model that gets an update and that the 11-inch model could be going away. I think the concept here is that Apple would maintain that as the entry-level price point, dropping it to that sub-$1,000 range. But I just don't see them doing that. I think they're going to simplify the line to simply the MacBook and the MacBook Pro lineup, and I think this is the event that they're going to do that at. It's also expected that we might see some new iMacs, also with integrated AMD graphics. We don't have a lot of information about what the iMac update would look like, but it's probably not going to be a huge design change. Again, updated processors, updated graphics, just updated specs across the board. And it's also thought that we might be finally seeing an Apple 5K display with an integrated GPU. We had heard that rumor back leading up, I think before WWDC, never really materialized, but this has been floating around for a while. The question becomes, is Apple going to get back into making displays, or are they going to continue to leave that to a third party? And I kind of feel 50-50 on that. I'm not really sure. I'd love to see a new Apple 5K display, but if we don't see it, it wouldn't shock me either. And I think lastly for this kind of event, the elephant in the room to me is the Mac Pro. Is Apple finally going to give something to their Pro customers? They've been waiting over 1,000 days. I think it's almost over 1,100 days since Apple did the Mac Pro update. And I guess you could also say there's a baby elephant in the room being the Mac Mini. That has been not getting a lot of love from Apple recently either. If they do update the Mac Mini, I think it would be just a minor processor bump. They might not even talk about it at the event. It could happen just quietly via Apple's website. But I think this is sort of the defining moment for both these product lines. Apple either needs to do something with them, rev them and update them, or let customers know that these models are no longer sort of part of the Mac lineup. And I'm really hoping for the former rather than the latter. I think it would be great to see a beefy Mac Pro update. Again, I wouldn't expect a big design change or any design change at all, really, but really just beefing up the internals, bringing them up to date, modernizing them, putting in Thunderbolt 3 ports, amazing graphics cards, really giving pros the machine that they want. And the timing would be perfect because as this event is happening, the Final Cut Pro Summit is also happening at the same time in Cupertino. So you've got all those creative professionals, those creative pros in Cupertino, and this would be a great thing to show off and really get them excited about the Mac again, because there is a lot of people in the pro community who are feeling disenfranchised. They are feeling like Apple hasn't been listening to them, that Apple has abandoned them. And this is the group of people that really is, I think, the foundation of the Mac market and continues to be that. But Apple is losing that. And the question is, does Apple care? And unfortunately, I kind of get the feeling that they don't at this point, that they're perfectly happy to focus on the high-end consumer with the iMac on the desktop and the MacBook Pro on the mobile, and then the core consumer with the other product lines, the MacBook and the lower end iMacs, along with their iOS devices, be it iPads or iPad Pros or what have you, iPhones, those sorts of things. And I think Apple's very happy with that market right now and is kind of feeling they don't need those two ends, the very low end, the entry level end, the halo effect coming from the PC market. I think they're getting that halo effect from iPhones and iPads. And then on the pro side, I think they just see that as such a small area of their market. But it really is an important one. I don't want to give anybody the impression that I personally think it's not important. I just question whether or not Apple sees it as part of their future. And more I'm feeling like they don't. And again, that's why I think this is a pivotal moment. This Mac event will really tell the world, is Apple still in that pro market, or are they seceding that to the PC world? And a lot of creative pros have already gone that direction. So Apple's already losing that. So again, this would be the pivotal moment. And it would be sad if Apple doesn't do it. But I guess we'll find out here in a couple days. But I'm very excited about the Mac announcement in general. I'd love to hear your thoughts. If you're looking forward to something in particular, let us know, maccast@gmail.com. So a magic toolbar is one thing. I mean, that's going to be a pretty cool little enhancement to the MacBook Pro, and I think it's going to be significant. But what about a whole entire dynamic keyboard, taking it to the next level? There was a post on Reddit this week that started off a rumor claiming that Apple was working on a new smart keyboard with dynamic keys. Now, the Magic Toolbar is rumored to be an OLED keyboard. The difference with this smart keyboard was that it was going to use e-ink keys. And the rumor goes that Apple was interested in this technology from an Australian startup called Sonder. They have this Bluetooth e-ink keyboard that was already shown off recently in Beijing, and it's expected to be out later this year. It's supposedly going to retail for around $200 US. And The Guardian backed this Reddit post with a story saying that they had a different source that claimed Tim Cook met with Sonder's founder on his recent trip to China. Now, the post seemed to imply that Apple might be looking to either acquire the company or invest in the company to develop this technology for future Mac products, whether that be a standalone keyboard or integration into a MacBook Pro. And the internet and the Mac community got kind of excited about this, but that was doused a little when Sonder released an official statement saying that the company had not met with Tim Cook, that they were not in talks with Apple, that they would love to be in talks with Apple. And Apple Insider even went further, saying that they think it might have even been an elaborate attempt by Sonder to kind of drum up some free marketing attention. So it would just be like kind of a marketing ploy. And I guess since I'm talking to you about it, it worked at least on some level. But still, this idea of a dynamic keyboard in a future Mac is, I think, really interesting. And I think it's also inevitable. I think we're moving in that direction. There is a lot of reasons to do this. And if you remember, like years ago, there was a lot of buzz around an OLED keyboard from a company called Optimus. They actually put out dynamic OLED keyboards, and they're very, very cool, but they're also very expensive, like $1,500, you know, almost as much or even more than some notebooks just for the keyboard. But the idea just makes sense for all of the reasons we were kind of talking about earlier with the Magic Toolbar, right? The ability to sort of dynamically control and change the layout and the keys on the keyboard dependent upon the application that you might be working in. Great for app-specific keys. So if you've ever seen like video editors, they use these overlays or even image editors, you could dynamically do that in software on the fly. It's also great in the fact that you wouldn't have to produce separate models of MacBooks or keyboards regionally, right? Right, like right now, you have regional keyboards that are completely different layouts, and being able to sort of dynamically change those would be very cool, and also could potentially save a lot of money. Whether it's OLED or e-ink, there's advantages to both. One of the big advantages of the e-ink technology is that it uses very little power. You only have to apply power to change the layout. So only if you were changing your settings or launching a new app would it have to apply power. So potentially it could last, especially in a wireless keyboard, a really, really long time in terms of the battery versus having to drive OLEDs that have to be powered up all of the time. Now, OLED obviously looks better. It's going to look cooler, but we may be a little bit further off, I think, with that technology. And there's also some more evidence that Apple is really thinking about keyboard technology. 9to5 Mac pointed out a patent called depressible keys with decoupled electrical and mechanical functionality. And what that all translates to is this idea of using an optical sensor to determine the distance, velocity, acceleration, and force being applied to a key press. And why would Apple be interested in that? Well, mainly because they're making everything so thin. As you know, Apple products keep getting thinner and thinner, and so they've been messing with the keyboard technology. The MacBook keyboard has this new butterfly key switch that's supposed to give a better tactile feel, but with less actual physical travel. And so what's going on here is Apple's trying to figure out, how do you give people the kind of mechanical feel that they want with a keyboard, but then maybe allow customers to actually customize that? Because different people like different things. Some people like a low travel keyboard. Some want a little more feedback. So the idea here would be you would have not just mechanical functionality, but also electrical functionality, so that if you wanted a shallow key press, you could adjust the springiness of the mechanical part, but not allow the key to go all the way down. The problem with not allowing the key to go all the way down, though, is that it's not going to make contact. It's not going to register as a click. So what they would couple this with is optical sensors that would be used when the mechanical key did not register contact. So you kind of get the best of both worlds. And that's really cool, combining the mechanical and the optical. But I also think that maybe, and this isn't part of the patent, I don't think, at least as I read it, but I think eventually we could get to the point where you have digital keys, or almost like you do now with the new home button on the iPhone, keys that feel like keys coupled with advanced haptic engine technology, and you're able to dynamically adjust how those feel. So you can simulate this idea that you have a lot of key travel, even if you don't. And I think eventually that's where we might be headed. Now, if you know my opinion about the new home button, I really don't like it versus the physical button. I think we're a ways off from achieving the kind of feel that is going to be really good. But I can see that Apple might be moving in this direction, and this latest patent seems to indicate that they're doing just that. So different kinds of keyboard technology showing up in the Apple news this week. Looks like we're seeing changes again to Titan, Apple's Titan. That's their rumored code name for their car project. Titan seems to be shrinking. Yep, again, and it seems like we've been here already. There were rumors when former Apple executive Bob Mansfield was brought back in to Apple to sort of rein back the growing Titan car project, because it was believed there was kind of a lack of focus or direction going on, that he sort of started slashing things, and we saw some rumors related to that. Well, now we're getting more rumors that Apple is changing the focus of Titan away from developing just a full-blown autonomous electric vehicle. I think originally it was rumored that Apple was just working on an electric vehicle, and then it kind of became, oh, they're working on an autonomous electric vehicle. But now what we're hearing is they're scaling back, they're looking at the project, and they're deciding we're going to design and build an autonomous car platform. The report says that, you know, since Mansfield came back, it looks like they've gotten rid of about 120 software engineers who were working on the operating system and testing procedures. They were let go, along with a few hundred engineers who were working on specifically the car stuff, the chassis, the suspensions, the undercarriages. So they're kind of doing away with the hardware. They're going to focus more on the software and the platform. And they say that doesn't necessarily mean that Apple's not going to make a car. They could come back. They could partner with someone to build it for them, or end up returning to building their own vehicle later if they can figure out if this platform is going to be viable. And they've reportedly set a deadline of late 2017 for figuring out the viability of doing some kind of autonomous car platform. At the height of the Titan project, it was said they had about 1,000 people working on it, and supposedly they were trying to target a release date of 2020. That's probably going to end up being a little bit later, if they decide to eventually move forward. They claim ultimately that the project suffered because Apple couldn't secure manufacturing deals for all of the car parts that they needed in the same way that they could for iPhones. Basically, Apple was having trouble pushing its weight around because they're not established in that industry. This is probably very much like the early days of the iPhone. Apple had to make some compromises. And as we know, Apple's not big on making compromises, especially when it comes to the supply chain. So my impression is what we're hearing now is just more of the same stuff that was going on, the stuff that Mansfield kicked off when he came back. It's just the cuts are getting a little bit deeper, and also likely we're just seeing more of the details about what's going on behind the scenes leaking out. And the report says that it's unlikely that Apple would want to license the technology if they decide that the research is viable. And I totally agree with that. If they figure out we've got a great platform here, I think they will return to developing all of that technology in-house themselves, and then either finding a really good partner, buying some sort of small car manufacturing company, something like that, to get the project going. But, you know, ultimately, too, I'm not entirely sure the research is going to bear out and show that this is a direction that Apple should be going in. I think really the future of vehicles, and this is just my personal opinion, is that the future of personal transportation is going to be car services, and specifically autonomous car services, sort of like ride sharing, almost like car sharing, where you buy time in a shared vehicle, a shared autonomous vehicle platform or service from a company. And I think Apple would be an ideal company to bring this. And it's basically a pay-as-you-go plan. Cars could be called on demand, or they could be set up based on your schedule, right? Think of how much your car maybe sits in your driveway or sits outside your office at work going unused. That's a lot of wasted time when it could be doing other things. And so why pay for a whole car when maybe you only need 10% or 20% of a car? And if we can get to the point where these things are autonomous, we already have iPhones, Apple already has the platform for sort of integrating this, knowing where you are at any given point, being able to call up a car on demand. And I think really that's the kind of thing that ultimately is going to be the future of transportation. I also see a lot of younger people, this is not myself, but a lot of younger people aren't as car crazy as maybe myself or other people out there, right? I depend on my car. I like the idea of having a car in the driveway, but I think future generations are going to get used to the idea that we don't need that sort of thing. If we can call up transportation on demand whenever we need it, that's good enough. I need to get from point A to point B, and you could have different kinds of vehicles for different purposes. So if I'm on the weekend needing to haul some stuff, I could call up a larger vehicle and maybe pay a little bit more, but just for that time that I'm using it, rather than having to have a whole other vehicle. And I think Apple's partnership with Didi Chung, the car service in China, is the perfect place to pilot this kind of project. I do think if Apple goes forward, they will end up building their own vehicles for this platform, for this system. But I think the service would be deeply integrated into the iPhone. In-car stuff, you could take your phone or your device, your tablet, drop it in there, and you could have all your customizations, your audio settings, your temperature settings for climate controls and stuff like that. It could all be personalized. You just wouldn't own the physical vehicle. And I think that's really kind of the future of transportation. Again, US is very car-centric, so I think this is going to be a harder sell here. But outside the United States, in places like China, Japan, maybe Europe, I think Apple could kind of put this thing together and ultimately make it really work. And I think it would be very interesting. So not too worried about the car project sort of changing direction and moving around. I think it's going to happen again before Apple reaches the end of this thing and kind of figures out where they're going to be going with it. Something you may have heard when you were a kid, often in grade school, is that A is for Apple. And it's looking like internally at Apple, A is also for AI and AR, meaning artificial intelligence and augmented reality. Tim Cook this week talked to the Japanese publication Nikkei, and explained a little bit about how Apple views AI technologies and how they integrate it into what they do. Basically, he said that they see the technology as a horizontal technology running across all of Apple products and not just the kinds of products that you would typically think about. So you might think AI, that naturally lends itself to things like maybe music recommendations inside Apple Music or into Siri technology, into interactive assistants. But he says they've also been using it under the hood for things like trying to get better battery life out of your iPhone or remembering where your car is parked. And I think the key point being that AI will be integrated in Apple products in ways that we'll notice, but in a lot of ways that we won't directly notice. It will be used to just make the things that we have seem to work better and smarter. And I think we're already seeing some of the advantages of Apple's recent investments, big investments and acquisitions in AI technologies, in machine learning technologies, and computer vision technologies. On the last show, we talked about technologies like memories inside the Photos app, and I explained how you use that. And the underlying technology in that is machine learning and AI all working inside the iPhone. And it's pretty incredible what it's able to do. Also, the new photo tagging technology that's in there. If you haven't tried that, I really encourage you to do that. Once your photos have been indexed, it visually looks at every image and categorizes what's in there. So you can literally type mountains or pine trees, and it's going to show you all of your photos that have mountains in them or pine trees, or you can say dog or cat, squirrel. And it does a pretty good job of finding that stuff. And that's all thanks to this kind of technology. And it's really stuff that I don't really care specifically how it works, just that it's in there and it makes this stuff possible. But these same kinds of technologies, while it might seem obvious for something like photo tagging, it also sits behind the magic of stuff like Proactive on your Mac, where the Mac ends up being a little bit more predictive, and probably a lot of other things that we don't really realize. So AI is a big part of Apple's future technology. Another thing that a lot of people are asking about right now is virtual reality. And Tim Cook talked in a recent BuzzFeed interview about the way Apple feels about virtual reality versus augmented reality. And for at least for Tim, he feels that augmented reality is the better technology, but the more appropriate technology for the kinds of things I think that Apple wants to do. He called VR very interesting, but mentioned he doesn't view it as a broad-based technology. It's sort of limited. We're seeing it used in games and some specific applications. I think it has some very interesting applications in medical and a lot of different verticals. But when Apple tends to look at technologies, they look for things that they can apply on a broad consumer level. And Tim seems to think that AR is more what he calls profound and will have a bigger impact, I guess. And he did admit that AR is going to take some time to get right. And in case you're wondering what the difference is or don't really know, so virtual reality is sort of when you put on headset or goggles and the external world is blotted out and you're put into a virtual world. You're transported to another place. Whereas augmented reality is meant to enhance the reality that you're already in. So you can think of like what Google was doing with Google Glass, or if you've ever seen a Pilot with a heads-up display. It's that kind of technology where you have a layer of information or a layer of technology that sits over what you're already seeing. And Tim really sees that ability to enhance these experiences without getting in the way of interactions as something really powerful. He says, quote, "You want the technology to amplify it, not be the barrier." And it meaning human interactions or conversations, the things that we do. You want the technology to enhance what you're already doing, not sort of be this curtain in front of it, or something that's taking you out of your current experience. So I think we can expect to see in future Apple technologies more and more AR coming into play, and how that's going to manifest itself is going to be very interesting. Certainly something with future iPhones and iPads coupled with maybe some other kind of device, be it glasses or some sort of display, maybe even contact lenses. We've seen some pretty interesting things. There's a company that's actually developing a technology that would allow you to overlay information using contact lenses, which is just amazing to me. I'd love to see Apple kind of come up with that kind of technology for augmented reality. But certainly, again, Apple's been making big investments in this area. They've been doing a lot of hires recently. We've been talking about those. So it's definitely a space to watch and probably one of the technologies that Apple's really going to put in the forefront in the future. Now, one concern I might have with AR and artificial intelligence when it comes to Apple is they often will throw a technology out there, sell us on something amazing, and then not really sort of, it feels to me like, follow through on it. And one of those recent technologies that I put in this category is HomeKit. I don't think it's in dire straits quite yet, but Apple needs to give it a little bit more love. They need to get it a little bit more mainstream and a little bit better integrated into our lives. And this week we saw some news that Apple is beginning to work with home builders to try and integrate HomeKit compatible products into new construction homes. So you'd be moving into a new house and you'd already have all of the HomeKit connected devices installed and ready to go. Just add your own iPhone and there you go. And in some cases, they're even going to provide an iPad or an iPhone to go along with it. So the concept is to sell the HomeKit integration, the Apple integration, before the customer even moves in, and basically lock them into the Apple ecosystem, right? Get them used to it. They were showing off this concept in Northern California with a couple of major U.S. home builders, Lennar and KB Homes. These guys are huge in the U.S. And another thing about this is doing it after market and kind of piecemeal can be very expensive. These integrations, they can add up to $2,000 to the cost of your home, maybe even more. One of the systems they were showing off, I think, was like $20,000 worth of gear. And it would include things like your lights, of course, but also thermostats, door locks, automated blinds, you name it, it's getting integrated. And if you roll it into the cost of a typical mortgage, it ends up being just pennies a month added on to your monthly payment. So it's a little bit easier to swallow for someone. And I think it's sort of brilliant. I just wonder if it's really going to make that much of an impact. Is it going to have the kind of halo effect? Is it enough at this point? Especially when the technology itself, the underlying technology, is still suffering from kind of feeling and being kludgy, not totally integrated. To me, the problem is not the individual devices that you can get for HomeKit. It's the integration and the compatibility. But presumably, if HomeKit would just work, then this could be a really big impact. But those of us who have been playing with HomeKit and trying it know we're not quite at that reality. So to put it in front of your average consumer, integrate it into their house, it has to just work seamlessly and easily. And I would worry that Apple's going to push forward with this and the experience isn't going to be good enough for people to really get on board. It's getting better. Things like integration in iOS with the Home app has made the experience better, but I still think Apple needs to do something on the hardware side. They need to come up with their own hub to kind of pull all of this stuff together and gain a little bit more control. You know, Google and Amazon are getting in on this game too. And, I think ultimately whoever can bring the best experience to the game is going to win over any specific kind of technology, whoever can pull the integration off. And Apple is really poised to be able to be the company that could do that. And they showed that off in the early days with HomeKit. It's just, once again, it feels like it's creeping along and not accelerating as fast as it should. So I hope Apple chooses to focus on that more. And I think if they can do that, this could be a huge success. But, you know, partnering to get it into homes and get it in front of consumers, good idea. But again, it needs to be seamless. You may or may not know that Apple has been in the process over the last year or so of making some pretty radical changes at a number of their Apple retail stores. They're going through this whole redesign. They've got some new stores coming on board. They've got this whole new concept in how they want to do retail. They want to make the Apple store kind of feel like a space where people want to come and hang out. They've always kind of been like that, but they're refocusing on the experience of using Apple products and trying to sort of center the store around that, creating kind of these meeting spaces. They're moving their accessories and products into areas they call avenues. The idea is like you'd be walking into a sort of retail area, but inside the Apple store. They're blurring the line between indoor and outdoor, creating these kind of spaces. And it's really cool. They've got these great, huge new displays, and a lot of people are really liking it. As a matter of fact, the Regent Street store in London was one of the latest ones to go through the redesign. And if you've seen the pictures of that, it's gorgeous. There are these great, great big open spaces, living walls, trees inside, very minimalistic, pure Apple design, and a really great space. They look awesome. And that's really cool. But there's another smaller change that Apple is rolling out, even in some of its existing stores recently, that you may or may not have noticed. Apple has started to remove the security tethers from their iPhone display models in a number of their retail locations. And when I heard this story, I was like, good riddance. I have been in more than one Apple store where a customer has accidentally set one of these things off, and the experience is horrific. The idea from Apple's perspective, I guess, is that they want customers to have a better experience in the store. It goes along with this whole redesigning the, you know, existing stores and the new stores. They basically want customers to come in, feel very open, feel like they can browse around, they can hang out, they can try out the products in the way that they would use them in the real world. And to have this corded tether, you really can't do that. You can't try out cases. You can't put the thing in your pocket in any kind of normal way without some sort of tether sticking out. So they're getting rid of them. And they seem to be gone from the iPhones at this point. They do remain on other products like MacBooks and MacBook Pros. But I think this is a good call. I think this is a good way to go. And some people are pointing out and saying, well, you know, what about theft? Is Apple going to see more thefts going on? And I really don't think so. Plus, Apple has other ways of minimizing theft. First, most of the locations have security and video surveillance. Sometimes you'll see security guards in the store. I think I've heard that often there's plainclothes security people that you may or may not notice. Video cameras, again, you don't often notice them, but Apple's pretty good at hiding those things. They don't want to detract from the customer experience, but that surveillance still is there. The devices themselves also are rumored to have some hidden tricks built into them. The hardware has a customized version of iOS and supposedly a software kill switch that will actually lock and disable the iPhone once they get out of range of the store Wi-Fi. So if a criminal does come in, they grab one and they try it and they run out of the store with it, even if they get away, it's going to be completely disabled. You're not going to be able to do anything with it. Now, of course, I would imagine, you know, they're already a person who's going to steal. They're probably unscrupulous enough to try and sell it on the black market. They might just sell it for parts. They might sell it to an unsuspecting person who doesn't realize that it's totally locked and you can't do anything with it. So I would say if you're buying a used iPhone, make sure you power it on. Make sure that you can log into it and it doesn't have an activation lock. If it does, it's pretty good sign that and if the person can't unlock it or says they can't unlock it or stalls with that, it's a pretty good sign that you probably don't want to pick that thing up. But really, ultimately, you know, the security tethers, I think Apple realized, were just more inconvenient for customers and really didn't do a whole bunch to deter theft. And as a matter of fact, not long after the removing the tether story broke, there was this story of thieves raiding a Massachusetts Apple store this week. And there, those phones were tethered, but it was a coordinated sort of attack. A bunch of guys came in, they cut the tethers, and within a matter of seconds, made off with about $13,000 worth of iPhones. And we've seen these kind of smash and grab robberies in Apple stores before. So the tethers weren't really doing a whole lot, I think, to deter that kind of theft. And also, if you've ever worked in retail, you know that a majority of the theft that happens there is what's called shrinkage, and that's employee theft. More theft happens from the people that are working in a retail place than typically your, you know, average shoplifter or something like that. So I like the fact that Apple has said, look, we're going to put the consumer experience first, and we're going to find a way to have deterrence without things like tethers that just get in the way of that experience. And also, I think you just don't want your customers feeling like criminals. You know, most of these measures ruin the experience for the consumer and others. Going back to my original thing, when I have seen a customer accidentally set off the security tether, first they're embarrassed. Then you've got the employee who's running around trying to figure out how to turn it off. And you have all the other customers who are in the store that are kind of disturbed looking over. It's a really irritating noise. So to get that experience away from the Apple retail store, I think is a great thing. I'm happy to see Apple opting for a better experience and worrying less about its losses from theft. There are a lot of people currently paying attention to what is going on with iPhone sales. And that's because Apple, over the last few quarters, has seen declining or slowing iPhone sales. And everybody's looking to the iPhone 7 to find out, is this a trend that's going to continue or is it something that is going to change? Well, there are starting to be reports that seem to indicate that the iPhone 7 may end up reversing the trend a little bit. And the first indicator comes from Apple's main chip supplier, TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation, or company. I can never remember which it is. I think it's corporation. But they are supposedly going to be reporting record revenue. Analysts have raised projected revenue growth for TSMC up to 10 to 12% from an earlier prediction of about 5 to 10%. And they say the change is based on demand for high-end smartphones continuing to improve. And since Apple accounts for about 10 to 15% of TSMC's revenues, and based on the timing of the iPhone, it seems likely that that could account for the nice little bump up that they might see. As a matter of fact, Apple might ship as many as 82 million iPhone 7s by the end of the year. And that prediction is up significantly from earlier estimates of between 60 to 65 million. So that does seem to suggest that iPhone 7 demand is remaining pretty high. And we had had earlier reports from carriers that they were seeing some of the best numbers for iPhone 7 that they've seen for iPhones in a while. And then, of course, poor Samsung, they had their issue with the Galaxy Note 7. The whole fire thing, in case you haven't caught on to that, Samsung was forced to recall and ultimately completely cancel their Galaxy Note 7 line. And because of that, Apple and iPhone 7 Plus sales are expected to benefit. As a matter of fact, I saw one survey that showed that about 43% of Samsung owners said they would not be buying another Samsung phone because of this incident. Surveys I kind of take with a grain of salt. I think Samsung fans are still Samsung fans. And I think they can ultimately look past this. But in the short term, Apple and maybe some of the other vendors like Google with their new Pixel that's out now, they're going to benefit a little bit. And as a matter of fact, KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that as many as 5 to 7 million previous Note customers may ultimately end up choosing an iPhone as their replacement. His only worry is that Apple might not be able to keep up with the new demand and that potential customers could opt for a different device rather than having to wait for an iPhone 7 Plus model. The Galaxy Note is a larger size phone, so it's assumed that most consumers, if they're going to switch from that to an iPhone, are going to go with the Plus. Now, good news is that I've been reading recent checks have indicated that most Apple retail stores have many of the iPhone 7 Plus models in stock at this point. Apple also recently started selling the SIM-free version of the iPhone 7, so the one that you can get without a carrier attachment, and that generally is a sign that inventory constraints are lightening. But there still is the jet black iPhone 7 Plus that is extremely back ordered. If you look at online orders, they seem to be slipping into December at this point, but I think it's only that one color that people might have to wait for. So Apple could lose a little ground there, but ultimately it's looking like iPhone 7 is going to do very well. And we will find out how iPhones do when Apple has its earnings results call, which is scheduled for the 25th, just 2 days before their Mac event, and it may be looking brighter than expected. iPhone 7s reportedly are accounting for about 43% of all iPhone sales in the quarter. This is according to Consumer Intelligence Research Partners. And this could be a good or bad thing, considering that the iPhone 7s were only available in the last 2 weeks of the year. So the bad news could be that iPhone sales were just so low and so bad that the iPhone 7 coming out can account for 43% of all sales. Or it could be the fact that Apple is just selling a ton of iPhone 7s right at launch. I tend to think it's probably going to be more toward the latter. The fact that potentially so many iPhones were sold in the quarter is a good thing for Apple's bottom line, since the average selling price of each device sold is higher than the previous generation. Apple makes more money off of each iPhone that they sell when a new model comes out. So that has many analysts adjusting their iPhone revenue predictions up, and it could end up being on the higher end of Apple's guidance. Apple had said in the last quarter that they expected fourth quarter 2016 revenue to be between $45.5 and $47.5 billion. Right now, some of the Wall Street predictions we are seeing are trending to the higher side of that estimate, somewhere around the $47 to $48 billion mark. And the only question that's going to remain is how much of that is iPhone sales, and more importantly, are iPhone sales once again trending up, especially in terms of unit numbers and revenue, or are we still kind of seeing the plateau and the decline? And we just have to wait till the 25th to get the answer to that. And then finally, in the news for this week, genuine Apple chargers on Amazon might not be all that genuine. And this story to me is a little bit scary. Patently, Apple has a story this week that Apple was notified by Amazon.com that counterfeit Apple chargers and lightning cables were being sold on their platform, Amazon's platform, as genuine Apple products. And what's really scary about this is in the listings, the products were labeled on Amazon as being quote unquote by Apple and were shipped and sold by Amazon.com. And if you looked at the listings, there really would be no indication to any reasonable consumer that these were not genuine Apple products. The only hint that this might not be a genuine Apple product would have been the price because it was about half of what you would expect to have paid in an Apple retail store. So Apple retails a charger for $20. These were being sold for $10. And the fake chargers were not only being sold on Amazon, they were also being sold via Groupon. And it turned out that these products were not only not genuine or made by Apple, but they had not gone through any safety testing whatsoever. No safety testing at all. And it looks like Amazon became aware of the issue when customer complaints went up and when they saw a lot of people reporting that these products were actually failing and in many cases catching fire, sometimes within hours of being plugged in and used. It's like, this is bad, scary stuff. After being notified, Apple started an internal investigation, and they actually found that almost as much as 90% of these products were counterfeit, being sold on Amazon. And they did a little more digging and traced a portion of these counterfeits back to a single source, a company out of New York called MobileStar LLC. Now, Amazon has already removed MobileStar's selling privileges, but I'm not so sure they just couldn't set up a new account under a different name and continue on sort of business as usual. Now, Apple filed a trademark infringement case against the company, and they're seeking an injunction to stop them from selling the counterfeit products. They're asking the company to destroy all of the counterfeit products, and they're looking for damages of $2 million per product type. But, you know, as with all lawsuits, this is going to take a while to go through. So the disturbing part to me really was how this company leveraged Amazon's brand to come off as trustworthy. And it's just sort of the structure of how Amazon is set up these days, right? Anybody can go on there, become an Amazon seller, and when a product says buy Apple, that just means that it's an Apple product, not that the company that's selling it is Apple. And I think myself included, a lot of consumers, when I see that, I think, oh, this is Apple selling the product. May or may not be the case. And as far as I see it, there's no way with Amazon's current selling model that this sort of thing couldn't happen again, either with this company or some other company. And another indicator in there that I often look for is who is it sold by and who ships it. And if I see sold and shipped by Amazon, and I see a title that says Apple Original OEM and it says by Apple, I think it's perfectly reasonable that you would assume it's coming directly from Apple, directly from a reliable source. And that turns out is really not how it works. That's not the case. So anybody could write anything sold and shipped by Amazon. Amazon provides shipping services and warehousing services for companies. So the way this works is you sign up with Amazon, you ship them the products, they store them in their warehouse, they'll handle all of the shipping and warehousing for a fee, and then you just collect the profit on top of that. So sold and shipped by Amazon really doesn't mean anything, and it's sort of buyer beware. So I would just say at this point, if you purchased any Apple genuine charger from Amazon and paid significantly less than the standard Apple retail price, and or it came in packaging that was not the official packaging from Apple, I'd be very suspect of it. Even if you ended up paying close to the Apple retail price, if it came from Amazon at this point, because Apple's investigation found that 90% of these things are counterfeit, I might not use it, and I might try to return it to Amazon and see if you can get your money back. Hopefully, they're going to honor that sort of thing. Who knows? Apple may even at some point come out with their own internal recall. Maybe they'll take some of these back and exchange them for Apple genuine products, because I'd hate to see anybody lose property or worse, lose their life over one of these stupid fake chargers that was sold as genuine from Amazon. This could be a, you know, end up being a really big lawsuit. I would expect we'll probably also see some class action coming out of this, in addition to Apple's own lawsuit filed against this one company. But this is pretty bad stuff here, and Amazon is probably going to get some attention on this, and I think that's a good thing, because hopefully they'll put in a little more controls, a little more regulations, so that companies can't pull off this kind of fakery in the future. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. I want to comment on something that we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast. I think I mentioned that after upgrading to iOS 10 and getting my iPhone 7, I started to notice that I was getting weaker LTE signals and even losing my LTE signal, having my phone drop down to 4G or even an edge connection in some cases, in places where it didn't do that before the upgrade. So there was kind of issues. There were also widely reported issues of Verizon iPhone 7s having cellular connectivity issues where they would drop connection or drop to slower connection. Well, Apple released iOS 10.0.3 for the iPhone 7 and the iPhone 7 Plus. 10.0.3 is only available for iPhone 7 models, and it included bug fixes for an issue where users could temporarily lose cellular connectivity. And I think after upgrading, I've noticed less issues personally with my iPhone. Many, like I said, Verizon customers were reporting the issue, but it didn't seem to be just isolated to that. So if you were having trouble with that, you probably want to make sure that you grab the 10.0.3 update. Prior to hearing this report, one thing that I was worried about was that it might be the new Intel modem in the AT&T phone. So one of the big changes that happened with the iPhone 7 was Apple switched for their GSM modems in the iPhone to using Intel modems versus the Qualcomm ones. And at first I thought, well, maybe there's a problem with that Intel modem. Well, it turns out this week there was another report that claimed that the modems from Intel might have a slight edge over the Qualcomm ones, at least when it comes to cellular data connectivity. And this comes from Cellular Insights. They did some testing and found that in some cases, the Intel modem in the iPhone 7 achieved better LTE data performance than the Qualcomm modem in the Verizon and Sprint phones, especially when it came to areas where you had a weaker signal. Of course, the Verizon and Sprint model phones have the advantage that they do both GSM and CDMA. So if you're traveling globally, if you need to take it into different regions with different cell technology, that's still probably the better model. But if you're looking for pure data performance on LTE, it's looking like the Intel modem is the better way to go. So just some interesting things with the latest iPhone 7 and cellular data connectivity that kind of happened this week. Here's something I never really thought about when Apple announced that the iPhone 7 was going to not have a physical home button, but, you know, this sort of virtual one that uses taptic or haptic feedback for its functionality. And that was, what happens when the technology fails? What happens when the button stops working? You don't have a physical button now. You're just going to have a thing where you're pressing on hard glass. Well, luckily, Apple did think about this scenario and built into iOS 10, I guess, a detection feature, a home button failure detection feature. And I would imagine this works as well if you have a physical button that fails. But apparently what it'll do is politely notify you that it's detected that your home button is broken, and it will display a virtual home button on your screen so that you can actually continue to use the phone in a somewhat normal fashion until you can get it in and get it repaired. And I thought this was pretty cool. I saw a screenshot of this online this week. There was an image posted at Mac Rumors, and you know, I can't confirm it completely, but to me it looks like just like the assistive touch home button that you can actually access from your iPhone if you go into settings, general accessibility. And I thought this was a good opportunity to kind of talk about that assistive touch feature in case you haven't encountered it or you don't know it. It's actually pretty cool. And I've seen people actually activate this on older phones where they've had a home button failure and they just don't want to pay for the repair. You can continue to use the phone using assistive touch. And you there's actually, if you look at this, a lot of reasons to activate it beyond just accessibility reasons. So even if you don't need it for accessibility purposes, you might want to check out putting this little virtual button on your screen. So you go into Settings, General Accessibility, find Assistive Touch, and if you turn it on, what you get is this little virtual button that appears on the screen. And you could have it on anywhere on the left edge of the screen or the right edge of the screen, and you can just simply drag it around to wherever you want. And what'll happen is when you tap on it, you'll get this little menu, and it will have different button controls or different controls on it. So you can tap it, and it has a home button functionality, so it will function just like the home button if you tap that. It will also, with a tap of the button, pull down the control center for you or pull up the notification center. So if you don't want to swipe, it will also activate Siri with a single tap. Well, I guess the first tap to bring up the menu and the second tap. But if you don't want to have to do the whole tap to hold thing to activate Siri. And it also has a menu for custom gestures. And what custom gestures allow you to do, there's a couple built-in ones. One is called pinch. So if you tap on that, you actually get a pinch control that you can control with one finger. It gives you this little virtual, like, almost looks like a barbell or a dumbbell slider. And as you slide your finger back and forth, the two points will move in and out, simulating a pinch in or pinch out gesture. There's also a 3D touch gesture. So if you have trouble force touching or, you know, force pressing on your device, you could activate that and simply tap to do a 3D touch. And there's also a double tap control where you can tap once and it will actually simulate a double tap in that area that you tapped. Plus, you can create your own custom gestures by recording a macro of swipes and taps. And this can be kind of cool if you have some sort of repetitive game where you're doing the same combination of swipes and gestures over and over again in a repetitive pattern. You could create a custom gesture for that, and then just with a single tap, it would play that back for you. And you could do it over and over again using the Assistive Touch feature. Another thing that Assistive Touch gives you is device controls that you can access. So these are buttons for things like locking the screen, rotating the screen, muting and unmuting, going volume up or down. So if you don't want to use the physical side buttons, if you'd rather do it all right there on the screen, you can do it from the Assistive Touch controls. And then under the More menu, they have additional gestures like shaking, accessing multitasking, taking a screenshot, which is actually convenient. So you could use the Assistive Touch button to simply tap once, tap into the device controls, and then take a screenshot. Plus, they have gestures including 2, 3, 4, and 5 finger swipes. You get these virtual fingers when you tap on those little touch points, and then again, you can use a single finger to do a 4 or a 5 finger swipe. Pretty interesting to think about. And in the Assistive Touch settings, you can even customize which items appear on the main menu screen when you tap the button. So this would be kind of a cool thing. Again, if you find that you take a lot of screenshots or you want really quick access to maybe a mute, unmute button, you could move that to the top level of the menu and access that literally with just 2 clicks, access any one of these things. So it's kind of a cool feature. It's built right into every iPhone running iOS 10 and 9. I forget when the feature was added in there. But just another example of where there's really cool stuff hidden down there in accessibility that actually anybody can really benefit from. So check that out. And if you know any other cool tips or tricks or ways that you use either this feature or any other accessibility feature, share it with us. Send me an email or an audio comment, mattcast@gmail.com, and we'll try and share more of these tips out on future episodes of the show. I want to bring up something with you, a conversation that I've been having a lot more these days, and it's, to me, puzzling in some ways, but not really surprising and in others. And that is this growing consensus that I don't want to say that there's something wrong with Siri, because I don't think that's quite the the right way to put it, but more that Apple might be becoming a little bit too complacent with Siri, and some of the other virtual digital assistants that are out there are catching up and maybe even surpassing Apple and Siri in terms of their usefulness and, more importantly, in terms of their intelligence. And the idea is like, hey, we had an intelligent assistant first. Ours should be the smartest because she's been learning and working with us the longest. But there are a lot of people out there, like Walt Mossberg this week. He wrote a piece in The Verge, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, asking why Siri, the intelligent assistant, can often seem so dumb. And I think a puzzling thing is, you know, again, why, when Siri was the first, why does she seem to be falling behind the competition? Google Now, Amazon Alexa, even Microsoft Cortana have gained ground and even surpassed Siri in terms of their usefulness. And I think in talking to a lot of people and asking a lot of questions, I think a big part of Siri coming off as seeming dumb or unintelligent or unaware when reacting to some of the queries that you might ask her is the general lack of awareness or context of what's going on when she's giving an answer or giving a response. So Apple has done a great job of improving Siri, of getting her to better understand us, better at parsing text. So very often now, it's not like back in the old days where you'd ask her something and she'd actually just get the text wrong and then be confused and you wouldn't get the right response because she literally didn't process what you were saying to her correctly. That seems to be largely fixed. So the puzzling thing now, I think, to a lot of people is she will fully understand the question that you're asking, but then just not get the right context or not be able to figure out what you're asking for and either give you an odd answer or, worse, go to that, oh, let me just give you a web search for this, something that you could have done on your own had you just fired up Safari or done a quick Google search. And so that's not really helpful, right? That's not being a great smart assistant. But beyond parsing the text and getting better at that, when it comes to actually processing this intent, she often falls short. And she does a great job of doing the stuff that she already knows, things like replying to texts or activating a timer or finding, you know, a local restaurant or a gas station or something like that. But if you try and do a broader request, something that a lot of other assistants are now tending to understand, she falls down. She falls short. She can't figure out what you're trying to get at. And basically, it feels like Apple's not letting her use the intelligence that she should have access to. Things like, imagine there's current events going on, like there's an election going on right now. She should be intelligent enough and fully aware enough to know that, oh, at this moment, a lot of people might be asking a lot of questions about the election. And if there's anything that falls within that context, I'm going to process the request with the assumption that, oh, they might be asking about the U.S. presidential election. But she's not doing that. She knows things like, I'm in the U.S. She can get that from the GPS coordinates. She knows that there is, or she could know, I guess. She probably doesn't know because it doesn't feel like that. She should know that there's a U.S. presidential election that's going to be on November 8th. And I tried this. I asked, you know, when is the election? And all I got from Siri was a web search result. But when I asked Google Now, same app or different app, but on my iPhone, so same device, just two different virtual assistants, I got the correct answer immediately from Google, yet Siri didn't know how to process that. And it's those kinds of interactions and things that are causing people to say, you know, Siri's not all that smart. She's kind of falling behind. She's not using this context. And, you know, an early ability touted by Apple was that Siri would be able to respond to one question And then using that as kind of a basis, you could ask further questions or you could kind of dig deeper, and the responses would be tailored based on the first question. And this kind of works in limited areas, but not really everywhere, and it doesn't feel like it's been expanded. On the Apple TV for movies or TV shows, for example, you can do this sort of thing. You can say, hey, Siri, show me comedies. And then you could say, okay, only the ones starring Chevy Chase. And it will filter down, and she'll understand that you're looking for comedies with Chevy Chase. But that doesn't work in a lot of areas. On the iPhone, it does seem to work for sports sometimes. Like, I can ask about an athlete and then ask for additional stats on that athlete, and she does a pretty good job at that. But if you ask a question, say, for example, how far is it from the Earth to the Moon? She will give you an answer, 230,192 miles. But if I then ask, and how far is that in meters? She doesn't understand that. She thinks that's a brand new query and actually tries to give me a map location. So then you think, okay, well, why don't I just rephrase it? Since I want the distance in meters, why don't I just ask that directly? So you go to ask a whole separate question. How far is it from the Earth to the Moon in meters? And you would think all is fine, but nope, what you get is, I can't find the moon in meters. Yet, if I say, what's the distance from the Earth to the Moon in meters? Everything is fine. So the only thing that I changed there is I added the word distance. What's the distance instead of how far is it from? And that's the kind of thing where she's not really parsing the intent. She's using the keyword, how far is it, to assume, oh, you want something from maps. And this happens over and over again. And it makes it harder to use Siri as a digital assistant. She needs to be, quote unquote, smarter about the kinds of things that we're asking. Now, often when you start having this conversation, some people will come to the defense of Siri and say, well, you know, Google and Alexa, they get an advantage because they don't really respect your privacy. And to a small degree, they do get an advantage from being able to share a lot of your data with outside services, right? They can tap into outside services. Well, Siri taps into outside services as well. A lot of the statistical data comes from Wolfram Alpha, and, you know, image searches come from Bing. So Apple does a little bit of that as well. But Apple is still falling short even on tapping into local data that it has access to, that it wouldn't have to do any compromises to privacy. So things like my contacts, my health data, my frequent location data, which is in my phone if I'm using GPS and location services, my calendar data, it's all in there. Stuff inside my emails that they could parse and use context from. All of that data from my photos that it now has. It knows where I'm taking photos, what's the subject of my photos are. Siri should be able to tap into that and use that as part of her intelligence and be able to parse things. You know, sometimes it's Siri also trying to be too smart, I think, that can make her feel dumb. She will sometimes use geolocation data and return local results when what you really want is a result based on a popular location. Walt Mossberg in his piece gave the example of asking, what's the weather like in Crete, or what's the weather in Crete? And Siri assumed he meant Crete, Illinois, instead of Greece, because he was geographically closer to Illinois when he was asking the question, right? But a smarter digital assistant would assume, well, more people are going to ask about weather in Greece, Crete, Greece, rather than, you know, this small place, Crete, Illinois. And he asked Apple about this, and Apple says it's because they're focused on getting better at the majority of queries that the most number of people are asking Siri on a daily basis. So they're analyzing the data, they're building into her intelligence, what are the common things that people are asking about all of the time, and we want to get really good at those things. And those would be things like placing phone calls, sending texts, finding places to go in maps. And we already agree that Siri's very good at that. She's been very good at that since, you know, pretty much the very beginning. And I think this is what's leading to this problem, that it doesn't feel like she's getting smarter. She's just kind of getting better at the things that she already knew how to do. And Apple even admitted to Mossberg that they don't worry as much about the less frequently asked things, what they call the long tail questions. But the trouble with this thinking is that it's the long tail type of questions that Apple's competitors seem to be getting better and better at dealing with. And they're the ones that make Siri come off looking like she's not as good, right? The ability to parse a more ambiguous query to most of us and get it right makes that assistant feel like it's more intelligent, that it's smarter. And so this is something that I think Apple needs to work on. And I don't think that Siri is bad or failing. I don't want to give that impression. But I also don't think that Apple is ignoring what's going on here. I think their heavy investment in artificial intelligence and other similar technologies says that they're up to something, but it just feels like they're moving too slowly, or just that they're doing too many things behind the scenes and we don't really know what's going on. Now, good news is they recently hired a Carnegie Mellon University professor, a guy named Russ, and I'm going to mutilate his last name, Russ Solokutinov. He was hired on at Apple as a director of AI research. And what's cool is he specializes in statistical machine learning, and he's written papers on neural networks, deep kernel learning, and reinforcement learning. And Apple's made other hires in this area recently. And I have to only imagine that this is part of some of this is being used to hopefully make Siri a better digital assistant. Apple is also close to finishing a new R&D research center in Yokohama, Japan. They say that's going to focus on deep engineering and developing artificial intelligence services. Again, something that would be great for Siri as well as some of the other things that Apple is doing. And Apple, you know, also I think has the advantage if they can pull this technology together in the fact that they control the whole chain of the process from the cloud to the software to the OS to the hardware all the way down to the chipsets to the metal. They can fine tune the hardware at the lowest levels to work with the software at the lowest levels to make this stuff really amazing. And that's an advantage that no other competitor currently has or is likely to have anytime in the future. So Apple can tweak anything that they want within that chain to get better results, better performance, better accuracy, better intelligence. They just need to move more quickly than sort of waiting between major releases of the operating system. I'm hoping that opening the APIs up to third-party developers is going to help. We're seeing some of that. But again, it can't just be this canned stuff. Siri has to be able to better process and understand context, more ambiguous queries, and get that stuff right. So maybe at the iPad event we're hearing about, possibly in the spring, Siri will get another little intelligence boost and upgrade and maybe catch up a little bit. But right now, I would agree with a lot of the people that I've been talking to. It feels like Siri's falling a little bit behind at this point. But that's just kind of what I've been thinking about this. I'd love to know what you've been thinking. If you've been thinking about this at all, please send me some feedback. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Ran across a cool little iOS 10 tip this week. This was a feature that I had heard about prior to iOS 10 coming out. It was something that I thought, you know, that's neat, but I wasn't really super excited about. And then I started reading a couple articles. I saw some demos of this and went, you know what? That's actually pretty cool. And as somebody who's aging and whose eyesight is generally getting a little bit worse, I'm even more impressed with it. And it is the iOS 10 magnifier. How you get to this, again, it's one of these accessibility features that can benefit a lot of us, is you go into settings, general accessibility, and there's an option called magnifier. And if you turn that on, the way that you can activate the magnifier once you have it enabled is you triple click the home button. Now, if you're using also the accessibility shortcuts, which has all kinds of other functionality that you can assign to a triple click of the home button, what you will end up getting is a pop-up menu. So if you have more than one accessibility shortcut set up, and magnifier is one of the accessibility shortcuts, when you triple tap the home button, or triple click the home button rather, it will pop up a little menu. But if you just have magnifier turned on, it will automatically jump right into the magnifier. And what the magnifier does when you activate it is it activates the camera on your iPhone, the EyeSight camera, and it will magnify any object that you put in front of it. And you can slide your finger on the main image area, just one finger, either up and down or left and right, and that will change the magnification. There's also a little slider control that you can use to change the magnification. If you tap the little flash button, the little lightning bolt, it will enable a light. So if you're, you know, turn the light on the iPhone. So if you're in a low light situation and need to get a little more light on something and magnify it at the same time, you can do that. Once the image is in focus, it will actually be auto-focusing on the image. You can tap the little lock icon to lock in that focal point. You can also tap anywhere on the screen to lock in the focal point, just like you would with the camera app. And then there's a shutter button, and while you might think that takes a picture, it actually doesn't when in magnifier mode. What it actually does is it freezes the frame of the image. The one thing about this feature that I noticed when I was using it is it can be a little slow. There's a little ring around that button, so wait for that to light up solid yellow before you move the phone. And so this is good if you're using the magnifier and you shake, like I have a little bit of handshake typically when I'm holding my device. It'll lock that image in place, and you can actually swipe to scroll around the image and pinch to zoom in and out of that image, and it'll keep it purely in focus. And then finally, there's also a filters button over on the right-hand side, and you can apply some different kinds of effects and filters to enhance the image and maybe give you a little bit better view of it. So there's brightness and contrast controls. There's some sliders there you can play around with. And you can also swipe between a number of different color filters. There's a white-blue filter, a yellow-blue filter, a grayscale mode, a yellow-black filter, and a red-black filter. And in addition, there's also an invert button where you can invert any of those color filters that you're on. And once you've applied that, when you go back to the image, it'll stay on that mode until you change it again. And then finally, to get out of the magnifier, all you have to do is press the home button. And once again, if you want to get back in, just simply triple-click it. So it's a pretty advanced feature. I thought this was just going to be a basic thing where it just kind of turned on the camera and let you zoom in and out. And I was like, well, we could already do that with the existing camera, right? You could just pull up the camera app and zoom in and out and magnify something. I've done that in the past, and I'm sure other people have as well. But this kind of takes it to a whole new level and actually is a pretty cool feature. So if you haven't checked it out, play around with it a little bit. And also, as a visual bonus, if you suffer from color blindness, iOS 10 has a new feature in it that can help you as well. And I guess like 10% of the population suffers from some sort of color blindness. So this is actually a cool feature for Apple to throw in there. Once again, it's part of the accessibility settings. So you access it from settings, general accessibility, and it's under display accommodations. There's actually a couple different kinds of display accommodations. You can invert colors from there. You can also reduce the white point, basically reducing the intensity of bright colors. But for people who suffer from color blindness, there's also now a set of color filters. So you can access this section of the display accommodations, and at the top, you'll see some different kind of what I'm going to call test palettes. It starts out with a set of colored pencils, If you swipe to the left or right, you can flip between them. There's a color grid with different kinds of colors. And then there's also this thing that looks like almost like a beehive with a bunch of different colors. I'm assuming it's a color blindness test strip of some kind. I'm not an expert in this area, but it looks kind of like the color blind sort of test dot patterns that you would be subjected to if someone was testing you for color blindness. So I'm assuming it's related to that. But in this color filters section, you can turn on various color filters for different kinds of color blindness. So there's a red-green one, a green-red one, and a blue-yellow one. And you can also adjust the intensity of the adjustment for each one of those kinds of filters. And then finally, there's also a color tint option that will allow you to select a custom hue and intensity to change the display. And kind of what I thought was cool about the color tint option was it's kind of a way for you to have your own custom and permanent version of night shift. So if you're a person who prefers your display to be a little bit warmer than a little bit cooler, you could actually change the warmth of the iPhone display to suit your own preferences and kind of lock it in using the display accommodations feature. And I know people who are like that. They're like, you know, this display is really too blue for me, or it's too much, you know, red, or whatever the color might be. And you can adjust it. But the cool thing about the color blindness filters is once you've applied them, basically what it'll do is it will move the color palette of everything on the display, photos, the icons, it will move it into a range of colors that you can see. So if you suffer from red-green color blindness, it will remove those colors and replace them with colors that you're more likely to be able to see. And I thought that was another really cool feature and another step up that Apple has made in the accessibility area. But again, once again, there are some things in here that can benefit everyone, not just people who need the accessibility features. So pretty neat stuff, and take some time to check it out if you haven't done that yet. David this week wrote in to ask me a question about Time Machine, and more specifically about encryption, because he mentioned, you know, I use FileVault on my hard drive to encrypt my hard drive, and I also use Time Machine, but I was wondering, you know, if you're going to bother to use FileVault to encrypt your main drive, should you be also encrypting your Time Machine drive? And David, I think the answer really is it depends. It depends on how important it is for you to protect all of your data, and also where do you want to protect your data. A lot of people will turn on FileVault because you have a laptop, and if you were on the road on vacation, you had taken your laptop with you somewhere and it got stolen, you'd want to know that all of your private data was protected. If you have a Time Machine backup, chances are that Time Machine backup is not on a portable drive. It's probably on a drive that's at your desktop back at home. And so you're not going to worry about that data. But what happens if someone were to, you know, and hopefully this doesn't happen to anyone, but it's something that can happen. Someone breaks into your house and they steal your laptop, but they also steal your backup drive, your Time Machine drive. Yeah, your laptop protected with FileVault is encrypted, but all of the data on your Time Machine drive, if you haven't encrypted it, that's accessible and could be used by the thief to, say, do identity theft or maybe get at your tax records or whatever might be stored on that backup drive. So in general, I would say that if you're bothering to encrypt your Mac with FileVault, you likely want the same kind of protection on your external drives and your backups. And luckily, enabling encryption on a Time Machine drive is fairly easy to do. When you first set it up is probably the easiest time to do it. So you select the Time Machine drive, you know, you go into System Preferences, you go into Time Machine, and when you're picking the drive to use for Time Machine, you'll see a little checkbox that says Encrypt Backups. All you have to do is, at the same time you select the Time Machine drive, check that box, and that will encrypt your Time Machine backups. And the encryption option is available if you have a time capsule, if you have disks connected to your Mac or on your network, or for any disks that you have physically connected that are partitioned using the GUID partition table scheme. So your typical Mac formatted drive should be able to be encrypted using this feature of Time Machine. And when you check that checkbox, you will be prompted for a password to encrypt the drive. The one thing I'm going to warn you about is do not lose or ever forget that password, because if you do, your backups are going to be useless for recovery. And the only thing you're going to be able to do with that backup is completely erase the drive and start over. So you want to make sure that, one, you use a strong, secure password for your encrypted drive, but also that you store that password, I would recommend, in a password manager like 1Password, or you could write it down. But if you write it down, make sure that that physical copy of your password is stored someplace secure. Don't put it in a Post-it attached to the hard drive that is encrypted, right? Make sure you lock it up, you store it in a secure place. But I prefer a password manager because, again, that's not something hopefully that the criminal is going to have access to should your drive get stolen. If you need to encrypt a Time Machine drive after the fact, it's a little bit trickier. Apple in their instructions says you need to remove the existing Time Machine drive and then re-add it and check that encrypt backup checkbox. But I did a little bit of testing, and what I found was that if you select the existing Time Machine volume under the list of available disks, so when you go into Time Machine preferences, what you'll see when you click select disk is you'll see the existing Time Machine drive at the top, and then you'll see a list of all of the other disks connected to your Mac. In that list will be your existing Time Machine drive. If you select it down there, then you will get the option for having the checkbox to encrypt the drive. And checking it, it will ask you to select a password, enter that to protect the drive. And that seems to preserve the existing backups and just start adding the encryption to the existing Time Machine drive. It worked for me. It worked for a couple other listeners who I had test this out. So I think you should be able to do it that way and you should be fine. Just note that it can take a really long time to encrypt the data on your drive. So you don't need to really worry about this, but you'll see a slow moving progress bar. Just let it do its thing. It's eventually going to encrypt that drive. You don't have to keep coming back and checking on it. It will get there. I wouldn't hover over it, because if you do, you're just going to be sitting there watching a progress bar for a really long time. So that's how you encrypt a Time Machine drive. Really pretty straightforward, really pretty easy. If you use another form of backup, if you use a clone backup like Super Duper or Carbon Copy Cloner, and you want to encrypt those backups as well, the process for that is a little bit trickier, but it's not too bad. What I would recommend is checking with the documentation on the developer's site for how best to do it, because it varies a little bit depending upon how you have things set up. And the main difference is, do you have an OS X recovery partition on that backup drive or not? So for example, if you use a Carbon Copy Cloner disk with an OS X recovery partition, what you need to do is start off by making a bootable backup using Carbon Copy Cloner without the encryption enabled on the backup drive. And then Carbon Copy Cloner recommends, once you have that backup, boot to your bootable Carbon Copy drive and go into the system preferences, into the settings, and enable File Vault 2. I'll have a link in the show notes to these instructions at maccast.com. Because I'm not giving you all of the fine details there. So make sure you go, if you're going to turn this on, and read those instructions there. If you want to create a bootable volume from a cloned backup, say Super Duper or Carbon Copy Cloner, but it doesn't have an OS X recovery partition. It's a little bit simpler. You should be able to simply go into the Finder, select the drive, right-click on it, and choose Encrypt and the drive name from the pop-up menu that comes up. And coincidentally, that's how you can also encrypt any other external drive that's connected to your Mac. You can literally now go into the Finder with the latest versions of OS of Mac OS and simply right-click on them and choose Encrypt. And that will encrypt that external drive. Again, you're going to be prompted for a password. Make sure that you remember what that is, because without it, you're not going to be able to decrypt your drive or get into it. I would also recommend, before doing any of this, that you have a full backup somewhere that is not encrypted. So don't encrypt everything all at once and then try and get into it and find out you have a problem. Do one drive at a time, encrypt it, make sure that you can access it, but make sure that you have an unencrypted version of that data lying around just in case something goes wrong, so that you have a way to back out of what you're doing. All right. Again, the encryption can take a long time. There really is no progress bar, but if you come back, you can kind of, again, right click on the drive and it'll show that it's in the process of encrypting. If you get to the point where you right click on the drive and it and the option changes from encrypt drive and now says decrypt drive, now you know that it's done doing all of the encryption and it's ready to go. And so that's kind of encryption for backup drives. Now, interestingly, John also emailed me and said, hey, can we get a refresher on using FileVault? I know I've talked about using FileVault and specifically FileVault 2 in the past, and I'm happy to do that, John. It's really pretty easy. There's not much to talk about. If you want to encrypt the drive on your Mac using FileVault, it's really just as easy as turning it on and setting a password. So go into System Preferences, Security and Privacy, and then click on the FileVault tab and just click FileVault on. Now, one of the questions it's going to ask you is, do you want to use your iCloud account, if you have an iCloud account, to unlock your disk and be able to reset your password if something could go wrong? The choice is up to you on this. I personally chose to use that option because, again, this would be a way to recover in case you did end up forgetting that password. But again, put it in your password manager and you won't have to worry about this. But if you don't choose to do that, what will happen is the system will give you a recovery key. And you'll want to take that recovery key again and put it in a password manager or make a printout of it and put it in a secure, safe, locked place that you can get at, because that is your form of recovery should you forget your password. And this sounds a little bit scary. I'm kind of making it probably more scary, sound more scary than it needs to be, because a lot of people worry about the hassles of enabling encryption. They think, okay, I'm going to enable encryption and I'm going to hit a bunch of roadblocks. It's going to be constantly asking me for passwords. It's going to be troublesome. I'm not going to be able to run backups the way I want to run backups. How does this all work? And all I can say is, as a general rule, if you enable FileVault, it will not make a difference to the things that you do on a daily basis at all. I worried about this for years and years and years, and then Victor Cahiao explained to me and convinced me, no, you don't have to worry about this with FileVault 2, because it was a problem back in the days of FileVault 1. A lot of people had very bad experiences. FileVault 2 has resolved a lot of the issues. When you create your password for your volume, you're given an option by the operating system to add that password into the macOS keychain. That means on future restarts or connects, it can actually auto-mount encrypted drives without having to prompt you for the password. Because if it's in the keychain and you've already authenticated to log into your Mac, the keychain is unlocked and it basically has access to that. So by accessing your Mac, you unlock all of your keychains, all of your drives, and you're good to go. And the point is once those are mounted and unencrypted or made available, then anything else that needs to use those drives, like your backups, they have full access as well. So you don't have to worry about that. Obviously, if you're going to put everything into the keychain, you want to make sure that your Mac is not set up to auto log on, because if you do that, then when a criminal gets your laptop, all they have to do is turn it on and they will have access to everything because it will auto fill in the password. So you want to make sure that your Mac is protected with your main account password. And as long as it's locked and you set it to lock when it goes to sleep, then no one can get in and access anything, any of your encrypted drives, without your login information. And of course, you want to make sure you have a good, strong login password. But all your backups are still going to work. You'll have full access when you're logged into your Mac. Scheduled processes, automated processes will continue to run fine as well. Even if your Mac goes to sleep and it's locked, the systems can still get in and access all of that stuff in the background when your machine's on, so you don't need to worry about that. So once encryption is set up, you really will not be able to tell the difference on a day-to-day basis. I've been using my machine with an encrypted drive for a few years now, and I've never run into a problem with the encryption. So again, I think it's very safe to use as long as you remember the rules of remembering your password. That's the main rule. Do not forget the encryption password that you're using, and you're not going to run into trouble. And I would also recommend saving the passwords into the Mac keychain. So I think that about covers all of the stuff I want to talk about in terms of encryption and Time Machine backups. If you have any questions related to that, always feel free to email me, maccast@gmail.com. And then the last thing that I have for you this week is my thing of the moment. And the best thing I can tell you about this thing of the moment this week is as little as possible. It's actually a game. The name of the game, I'll give you that, is called Black Box. And it's called Black Box because the whole concept of it is to act like a black box, something that is a bit of a mystery, something that you don't know anything about or you know very little about. And that's because it's a puzzle game, but it comes with almost no instruction whatsoever. What they give you is a box, actually a grid of kind of boxes, little squares. They have a little dot inside of them. And when you tap on one, you're given a puzzle. And within the puzzle, there'll be one or two or three or four, there'll be a number of these little squares. And the idea of each puzzle is to figure out how to get the square to go from being an outline with a little dot to being turned on. They actually call these little squares lights in the game. And so you're trying to light up the square by completing some sort of series of actions. And most of the actions are physical things that you do with your device. They're not going to be interactions that you're going to do necessarily directly with the app. As a matter of fact, tapping on the screen when you're in a puzzle will typically take you back to the main screen. So you're not tapping or swiping on these things. You're doing some other thing. What that is, that's the challenge of the game. Figuring out what you're supposed to do to turn that little light on, to turn that little cube on, is the thing that you need to do to pass each level. Now, some of the puzzles will give you kind of a vague on-screen visual cue, an indicator as to what the task is that you're supposed to perform, but by design, you have almost nothing to go on. It is the most frustrating and fun game that I've played in a long time. It is very, very challenging. You will get very frustrated, very angry. All I can recommend is, you know, the walk away technique works very well. Just put it down, although you won't want to put it down. I'm so addicted to it. You sit there and you want to keep trying things, but often, you know, it's that situation where if you just step away from it a little bit and come back to it, then boom, suddenly the answer comes to you. Or maybe even when you're away from the game, the answer comes to you. You do get the option to take hints if you get stuck. So there are in-game hints that give you 2 freebies to start off. But after that, you either have to earn more or buy more. There is in-app purchase. You can buy more hints. You can also earn more hints by sharing the game with friends and family. And the game is free. It lets you access dozens of different challenges for free, different puzzles for free. But they also have in-app purchases for more advanced levels and puzzles. And the developer has said that he plans to release more in the future. The game is so fun. I absolutely hate it because it's so frustrating. But if you do decide to try it out, please use my link that I'm going to have in the show notes at maccast.com. Because, again, one of the ways that you can earn free hints is by sharing it with friends. So I'm going to share the game with you. If you use my link, I'm going to get more hints and I'll be able to solve more puzzles. I will tell you right now, I have had to take many, many hints to be able to figure out what to do. And very often, even with the hint, I'm stuck on a particular puzzle. So a lot of fun. I think it's really innovative and great game. Black Box, check it out. You can find it on the App Store. And that is my thing of the moment for this week. And with that, that is going to do it for this week's episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with Text Expander for iOS. You can get more information and details on all of the great Smile applications by going to smilesoftware.com/maccast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails or audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, you want to follow me online between shows, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. You'll find that at google.com/plusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.